TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. In common history, Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima represent the beginning and the end events of World War II, suggesting that the attack on Pearl Harbor forced the U.S. into war and that the bombing of Hiroshima saved the lives of 1 million U.S. soldiers. With help from long-ignored or classified information, Arjun Makhijani reanalyzes both events. This talk, given to Nuke Free Now in August 2012, near the Los Alamos Weapons Lab, presents thought-provoking information about how nuclear weapons were invented and who really was in control of their first use. Makhijani, with a PhD from UC Berkeley for his work on nuclear fusion, has long explored the role of scientists in the Manhattan Project. In part one of this talk, Makhijani asked the audience if they knew the engineer and inventor Vannevar Bush. Very few raised their hands, and Makhijani remarked that that was sad, since Bush was, quote, the principal architect of my story. Vannevar Bush was the first presidential science advisor and coordinated around 6,000 scientists who were working on war technologies. He was director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development in the Roosevelt White House, the very organization that initiated the Manhattan Project. At the end of part one, Makhijani raised the baffling question how it had been possible to exclude almost all military and civilian leaders of the World War II war effort, from the Pentagon to Congress and the U.S. government, including even the vice president, from knowing about and influencing the Manhattan Project. He is Arjun Makhijani.
Most generals who were prosecuting the war had no clue about the Manhattan Project. They did not know it existed. They were not told. Even Admiral Leahy, who was Roosevelt's liaison with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with the generals in the Pentagon. And Leahy worked in the White House. He found out by accident when Lord Chirwell, Churchill's science advisor, was visiting Roosevelt in 1944, and Chirwell could not imagine that Leahy would not know about the bomb project, and he talked about it. That's how Admiral Leahy found out. MacArthur was informed by memo on July 30th, I believe, 1940, what do you think? July 30th, 1945, that this bombing was going to take place. He also had no clue. The list is pretty long. The people on this committee, chair was Vannevar Bush. He had James Conant, so two scientists. They didn't let any of the other scientists know anything of what I'm going to tell you. So they were supposed to be representing the scientists, or so the scientists may have thought. General Groves, of course, who was the executive director of the Manhattan Project, effectively. And then there was another general who was part of the construction, General Steyer. And there was an admiral, Admiral Pernell, who was in charge of new weapons in the Pentagon. There was no liaison with what was going on in the war. So nuclear weapons are already detached from the war effort. May 5th, 1943, will you promise to help me make this date famous? May 5th, 1943, the Military Policy Committee met to review the progress of the project. The last paragraph in the minutes relates to targeting, and I believe it was the first targeting decision that was ever made. So they decided to detarget Germany. They decided they were not going to target Germany. It wasn't because of race. So far as I can tell from this and other research, there was a lot of racism against the Japanese. Of course, you know that. We know that. There were all the internment camps and so on. Plutonium was race-free, as it turned out. The Japanese were selected for targeting. This is a quote. As they would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it. The it refers to the bomb in case it is a dud. So the whole reasoning was, what happens if the bomb is a dud? So the Japanese would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it as would the Germans. So the Germans had Heisenberg. It was not a racist thing. It was a good evaluation. So from May 5th, 1943, to the bombing of Japan, Germany was never targeted. It was not. There is no evidence to that fact. Churchill and Roosevelt, when they met in 1944, actually Churchill said something like, after mature consideration, we might use the bomb against Japan. Churchill did not, so far as I know, ever raise the question of the bomb being used in Europe against Germany. When Truman became president after Roosevelt died, as vice president, did not know about the Manhattan Project. In fact, he has written a threatening letter as a senator that you're spending all this money in 1944. If you don't let me investigate it, and they didn't, there's going to be some price to pay if I discover race, fraud, and abuse, which is still a common phrase. We're still waiting to discover it, right? So Groves briefs the president in April 23rd, I think, 1945, and he tells the president, the target is and was always expected to be Japan. I wasn't the first to discover this. These memos have been declassified. This has been written about in the official AEC history of the war, and first in the 1960s of the Manhattan Project. But I do think I can claim to be the first to see the significance of this. So I interviewed the scientists in an article I wrote for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So I called up Robert Serber, who worked with Oppenheimer. I called Joe Rotblat. I was privileged to know Joe. And I called up Glenn Seaborg for separate plutonium. I called up Hans Bethe, the director of the theoretical division in Los Alamos during the war. Good people. Not a single one of them knew in 1995. They all believed the bomb was used in Japan because the war was over too soon in Germany. They were surprised that Germany had been detargeted in 1943. So, now Joe Rotblat's decision to leave assumes a greater significance. But think that if you have contributed to the destruction of two cities, how much curiosity should you have about what went into the decision? This is an important question I would like to ask Los Alamos scientists. So, we know the sequence to the bombing of Hiroshima. Now in 1944, the United States is looking to the end of the war. Dean Acheson was the Secretary of State. Do you know what his memoir was called? Present at the Creation. He testified to Congress, you could probably fix it so that everything produced here would be consumed here. Mark these words. That would completely change our Constitution, our relations to property, human liberty, our very conception of law, and nobody contemplates that. Therefore, you must look to other markets, and those markets are abroad. Enter the nephew of Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. The nephew of Henry Stimson, Alfred Loomis, was a Wall Street banker, an amateur physicist, who had a mansion in a place called Tuxedo Park. And many of the famous physicists passed through Tuxedo Park, and the invention of radar started in his basement. Fermi went there, Lawrence went there, Niels Bohr went there. He's one of the most colorful characters in American history. Some economist is supposed to have sent, I think it was Loomis who sent a note to his uncle saying in early 1945, look, the Soviets are occupied a good bit of Europe. 200 million people are in that part of Europe. We're going to lose those markets to socialism. So he writes this long memorandum. Let's compromise with the Japanese so that the Soviets don't enter the war in the East and occupy China and Japan, and we lose those markets too. And so let's give up unconditional surrender. let's give the Japanese Korea, you know, let's throw something nice to the imperialists. So the Wall Street will come out well. And by the way, I think 500,000 to 1 million lives would be saved because American soldiers wouldn't be forced to fight the war to the end. So now you know where that number first came from. So Stimson sent this to General Marshall and said, give me your review of this. General Marshall sends it off to his general staff. General Staff sent back a note saying, we don't think we should give up on unconditional surrender, and we think that the estimate of 500,000 lives saved by not invading Japan is, quote, entirely too high. Okay. General Marshall forwards to Stimson. Policy is maintained. Now come July 1945. The Japanese are at the end of their ropes. Cities are being firebombed. Their supplies are cut off. Their people are starving. Their soldiers who are out, you know, in the far posts have little to eat. The war was essentially over 6 months before that, at least. The Japanese are wanting to surrender, but they want their emperor to stay. The Japanese militarists, this is a Japanese, when I say Japanese, I mean the Japanese ruling class. Nobody consulted the public. For the Japanese ruling class, the emperor staying was more important than the lives of the people. Between the Potsdam Declaration, when they said unconditional surrender, and the bombing of Hiroshima, I think 10,000 people died in firebombings. Now, they said emperor must stay. This message was conveyed by the Soviets, who were not yet in the war, to the Americans. Americans replied unconditional surrender, no deal. Americans, of course, at this time also had broken the code of the Japanese, and they knew all of this. The Soviets didn't have to tell them that. Meanwhile, the bomb is ready. MacArthur has been informed, and it is used on the first day that the weather permits. So this is very important to understanding. As important as everything else is the fact that the bombs were used as soon as they were ready. First bomb on August 6th, second bomb on August 9th. First clear weather day. Actually, the target was not even clear weather for the second bomb. Nagasaki was kind of picked up as a target. It was not on the original preferred target list because it had already been damaged by prior bombings, and they wanted, there was an experimental aspect to these bombings. It was not the main aspect, but there was, they wanted to know what bombs would do on undamaged cities, and some cities had been named as not to be bombed. The Soviets entered the war just before the bombing of Nagasaki. What happened in Japan on August 6th? Of course, they knew time is up. The next 9 days have an immense debate around them. The best that I can tell, they knew this is a new weapon. The Japanese still want the emperor to stay. They still are not ready for unconditional surrender. The Soviets enter the war. This is a big shock because the Japanese are still hoping that the Soviets will mediate a surrender with appropriate conditions. Soviets enter the war. Truman has said before the bomb test, I think, in his diary that Soviets enter the war, Japan will surrender. That was his view. But after the bomb test, the U.S. actually did not want the Soviet to enter the war because of what I have told you. The idea was we should keep the markets. So Okinawa has been conquered, and things have been stopped at that point because the next step is very big, which is the invasion of Kyushu, the southern island of the main part of Japan. And this, they knew, would be a very big deal. And so it was not due to start till November 1. Almost 3 months. Now, here's what totally convinced me that the bombings are completely illegitimate. Now I have told you what I think. Is because they themselves believed that the Soviet entry may precipitate the surrender. And there is no price for the Americans to wait for 10 days. No price. Soviets could not have occupied a big area in a day, right? It takes time to move those armies. But they decided to use the bombs. And the second bomb was used also as soon as. In the end, the Americans apparently covertly agreed to let the emperor stay. So the emperor of Japan and the elite of Japan, even after two atomic bombings, did not care enough of their own people to agree to unconditional surrender terms. This is a very important thing to know about the Japanese militarists. So if you think that Americans are responsible for that decision, and I think they are, because it was their bomb and they decided to use it, you have to think who was in charge in Japan. This is very important for us to acknowledge. This will start a conversation in the United States. And I want a broader conversation to start. I have done this in the panhandle of Texas, in the home of farmer friends. And my farmer friends in the panhandle of Texas said, let's go and get rid of nuclear weapons. Let's get children out of the way of war. That's why I'm bringing you this message, because I am convinced that this message is more truthful. And I see Gandhi t-shirts here. I admire Gandhi most for two things. And there are things I'm very critical of Gandhi, as an Indian especially. The bringing of truth into politics. That's why I regard him as the greatest political person in history. And he said, if you want a good result, you've got to have a good process. We haven't had a good process so far because we have not acknowledged the truth in the other side. All right, a couple of other things. So I promised you I would bring civilization back into this picture. When Stimson briefed Truman after he became president, April 1945, here's what he told Truman. If the problem of the proper use of this weapon can be solved, we would then have the opportunity to bring the world into a pattern in which the peace of the world and our civilization can be saved. All right. Now you must reflect on the character of the civilization. Here in Los Alamos, on August 6th, Richard Feynman, a great physicist, and I believe in 1980 became a greater man. Remembering August 6th, he said this. The only reaction I remember, perhaps I was blinded by my own reaction, was a very considerable elation and excitement. And there were parties, and people got drunk, and it would make a tremendously interesting contrast what was going on in Los Alamos at the same time as what was going on in Hiroshima. I was involved with this happy thing at the same time as people were dying and struggling in Hiroshima. This was an interview with the BBC, I think around 1980. And then he reflects, with regard to moral questions, I do have something I would like to say. Because the original reason to start the project, which I had, was that the Germans were a danger. But what I did, immorally, I would say, was to not remember the reason that I said I was doing it. So that when the reason changed, which was that Germany was defeated, not the singlest thought came to my mind at all about that. That meant now I would have to reconsider why I am continuing to do this. This is from one of the most brilliant physicists in the 20th century, which was full of brilliant physicists. I simply didn't think, okay? That's what he said. Now, I think the people who repeat this thing about 500,000 to 1,000,000 lives saved, I would bet the vast majority of them have no clue where it came from. They also don't know what the general said, which is something between 20-odd thousand American lives would be lost, and 46,000, I think. And they had various scenarios for the war. There's actually cable correspondence after the war when somebody said 200,000, I believed it was Henry Stimson, that should we correct the Secretary of War because the estimate was tens of thousands. And the overall decision was, don't get mixed up in it and give the Japanese a propaganda advantage. And then Truman wrote 250,000 in the first draft of his memoir, and then he felt it wasn't good enough, and in the final version which was published, he said, and I believe this is pretty close to an exact quote, General Marshall told me that 500,000 lives would be saved. And I have just told you what General Marshall forwarded during the war to the president, and Truman was president in June, that contained a slip from the staff evaluation saying that estimate was entirely too high. But I can give you some facts that throw some doubt on this assertion. I really want to enter into a conversation with Los Alamos scientists about this, because they're wedded to the bomb by habit. They're wedded to the bomb because, as Mr. Truman is supposed to have said, that the most sensitive nerve in the human anatomy runs through the pocketbook. And I actually have reflected a lot on this, and I think all of us who live in civilization, and this is part of the character of civilization, have rerouted our entire sensory systems through our pocketbooks. Of necessity, I'm not condemning it. I'm saying, if you want to extract yourself from the worst moral consequences of the kind of civilization we live in, then we must recognize the truth of this. I don't think Los Alamos scientists will listen to me, but I hope that they respect Richard Feynman. I would not put Richard Feynman on the same plane as Joe Rotblat, who is the only hero scientist in my book. Joe Rotblat quit the Manhattan Project when it became known that Germany did not have a viable bomb project, but he was the only one. Well, there was Leo Szilard, who started the thing and tried to stop the bombing and went to Jimmy Burns, who was Secretary of State, and said, really, don't do this. And one of the main reasons for dropping the bomb, and I'll stop here, was that the expenses on this project needed to be justified. Groves has said, and this is a paraphrase, that if the project is seen as a success, we will be celebrated. If it is seen as a failure, Congress will investigate, nothing else. So this was a dominant reason for the rush. But I believe those who have said it was a message to the Soviets and the world are also right, because Groves has said the bomb project was carried out with the idea that the Soviets were the enemy. It's interesting, so many vignettes. DuPont ran Hanford, where the plutonium was made for the Nagasaki bomb. But do you know that Groves thought that he didn't have the time to investigate DuPont and their fascist connections, and that he would trust their patriotism to do it right? At a time when they kept the Manhattan Project secret from all but a handful of members of Congress, and I do not believe even a handful of the actual leaders who were responsible for the conduct of the war. But I will leave you with this, that our side, who wants disarmament, has been, not everybody, has been a little afraid of the truth. As a result, we have been painted into a corner that the right wing may well call the dump on America crowd. You know, often called that. And I would say, if we reflect on it really honestly, you have to say that giving such a one-sided view of what happened in World War II lets too many parties off the hook, including the Americans. Because if you don't ask what the fleet was doing in Pearl Harbor, you'll never understand about oil or the Indonesians. So if we want disarmament, we must be bolder and start a more respectful conversation. We need a better conversation with Los Alamos, and we need a better conversation with the American public. I'm convinced that nuclear weapons have become today from a high-tech instrument, a monopoly of the most powerful in 1945, to an instrument of terror of North Korea, which is an impoverished state with lots and lots of hungry people. It has become an instrument of response of the poor dictators who want to terrorize others instead of the instrument of domination of the rich who want to terrorize others. And nuclear weapons were built. The whole of air warfare was designed as a warfare of terror. It's a next talk. But please take this away. Process is very important, and we must not forget Pearl Harbor nor Hiroshima. We must understand both things, and we must bring more of the truth to Los Alamos and the country, because the other side isn't going to do it. Right? You know, the nuclear power companies aren't going to rush and say, let's have a carbon-free, nuclear-free economy. Are you seeing them rushing? They say, well, let's put solar on the table, let's put nuclear on the table, let's have a smorgasbord of energy, and we'll all be happy. So let's do that. Thank you very much for letting me do this and inviting me.
That was the conclusion of the one-hour talk from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima by Arjun Makhijani at the Nuke Free Now conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on August 4, 2012. Makhijani, originally from Mumbai, India, holds a PhD in engineering from UC Berkeley for his work on nuclear fusion. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Maryland. The website is ieer.org. Thanks so much to Mike McCormick for sending me the audio for this program. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.